Talk given Friday, 23rd March, 1973. You may recollect that last time we considered the Kabbalah and the Veda in a general way. The approach of the Kabbalah is perhaps mainly the approach through the understanding of power. That is to say, the understanding of the play of cosmic energies. The approach which you find in the Veda also has the approach in terms of the play of cosmic energies, but perhaps it lays more emphasis upon the approach through wisdom and compassion as well. This is not to suggest that the Kabbalah has not the approach through compassion and wisdom, particularly through wisdom. The Zohar, for example, certainly gives you all that aspect. But the original key to understanding the Kabbalah lies in understanding what they called the letter number code to unlock the mysteries of the Kabbalah. And the main part of the Kabbalah, which can be approached that way and should be approached that way, is of course in what we call the books of Moses. Now I'm going to leave the Kabbalah alone altogether today, if I can, and we'll concentrate a little more upon the approach through the Veda. The Veda means, of course, as you know, the hymns of the Rig Veda primarily. Then there are the other three Vedas, as they are called, Sama, Yajur, and the Atharva. Then there are the writings which are very important, known as the Aranyakas, which culminate in the Upanishads. And you all know that the basic topic of consideration of the Upanishads is summed up in those two words, Brahman and Atma. You may also recollect, I have always stressed, emphasized very strongly, that the approach can never be, should never be, in terms of an intellectual discussion about the nature of Brahman or Atma. In the religious context, understanding is a matter of personal realization. The words Brahman and Atma represent realized transcendence. And realization takes place in terms of consciousness, of awareness, which is actually far profounder than merely deep states of mind as such. Consciousness is very fundamental. It is that in us which is nearest in function to transcendence itself, to transcendent energy. And when this complete change, this fruition comes into being in terms of consciousness, the fruition which I suggest can be put into words like this, realized transcendence, When that comes into being, one's religiousness has come to full flower. Now, in this coming to fruition, there are certain fundamental aspects as regards the living of the life, which we commonly call discipline, training, and so forth. The absolutely indispensable foundation is morality, purity, constant purity, the process of life continuously is a process of purification, of remaining pure. Let me use another term, of remaining healthy. Not merely healthy in body, but completely healthy in mind and heart and in every way. Completely whole, which means holy, which means that man has come to his fruition. That is the absolutely indispensable foundation for it all. Another aspect is what we commonly call meditation, samadhi. On this there are all kinds of confused views. There is the tendency to associate the word meditation, or if you like the theistic term, contemplative prayer, or deep samadhi, use what term you like, to associate it too much with a particular technique as such. Samadhi means the state of communion, complete, perfect communion. And communion in this religious context is not a matter of 5 minutes or 5 hours during the day or something. It is a total state. It is a total thing. One's being is totally, continuously in communion, which means that the transcendent reality, the one total reality, is not obstructed by me at any time. That is the meaning of my being in meditation. But of course, that is the culmination. That is the complete fruition, the flowering out of man in his full manhood, which is identical with his godhood. You will find the great mysticisms also emphasizing this, that it is actually the deification in consciousness. And as and when there is deification in consciousness, once and for all it is there permanently. Time has disappeared and eternity is everlastingly present. The everlasting now is there. And this everlasting now moves through time, because there's no other way of manifesting eternity as a living reality unless it rides on the wings of time. Now, meditation then means that state of communion. But before we get to that full fruition, naturally, there are for us ups and downs, or shall I say, ins and outs. We are in the arms of the transcendent, and then we feel like running after something, and we jump out, have our little fling, and come back to Father, so to say. Now, there is also, having said that, we must realize that there is also the specific aspect of meditation. The specific aspect wherein one deliberately makes the effort, does the job, so to say. Now do realize that this, doing the job, 10 minutes in the morning or 5 hours in the evening or whatever it is a way of sensitizing our whole psychophysical being more and more. It is this sensitization which is of the utmost importance. Consider, if I am not sensitive to transcendence, transcendence won't do anything to me. It is I who have to grow in sensitivity, and then, because to the extent I'm sensitive, I'm not obstructing transcendence, transcendence flows into me and through me. And when my sensitivity has reached its full possibility, its uttermost, then I am perpetually in communion. I am like a receiving set which at no time is turned off. It's always on. It's functioning. And then this sensitivity which was made to grow, the Buddha's phrase was made to become, to make become. That's a curious phrase he had. This sensitivity, which was made to grow, has come to its fruition through the specific efforts we make, and then the whole of life is one long communion. A state of communion. Do realize it. It is not a communion of you or me with transcendence or God or the deity or some supreme power or the absolute or anything like that. The state of communion prevails. You see, first of all, we have to use the intellect to begin to know these things. Then, when the sensitivity is there, the profound understanding grows. The intellect must be clear of all inadequate formulations. It's not that God and I are in communion, but the state of communion prevails. And when that state of communion prevails, then there is no isolated, self-conscious I. There is, of course, what is commonly called me. There is, of course, what is commonly called the totality or God or whatever you like. But the actuality is that it is a one total, unbroken holiness. Now this we must not only see with the intellect, we must feel it completely with all the sensitivity in our being. Feel it not emotionally, or feel it merely corresponding to our physical sense of touch. More than that, this feeling of the whole being for this means that you have become it. It permeates your whole being. It is your whole being. Then, very simply, I am a man. in that state. Until then, I am sub-man. So now these words, Brahman and Atma, which stand for realized transcendence, there are one or two things I will read, just little quotations, and we shall meditate upon them one by one afterwards. Yajnavalkya speaks. He has been asked the question. He has been requested to expound what is the inner controller within man. And he gives one of his many wonderful expositions about the Atma. And he ends up by saying, he is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the ununderstood understander. Other than he, there is no seer. Other than he, there is no hearer, no thinker, no understander. He is the Atma, the inner controller, immortal. You'll notice in the context, the translation uses the word he, simply because the word Atma has this strongly subjective flavor to it. Brahman is always referred to as it, because it is the objective word. Now, this Atma or Brahman, now you have it more in the form of Brahman. Yajnavalkya, again, is talking to one of the very remarkable women of that age, Gargi Vachaknavi. That means Gargi, the daughter of Vachaknu. She has asked him a question, and he gives an answer to it. And she asks a further question in connection with it. And Yajnavalkya answers, that, O Gargi, Brahmins call the imperishable. It is not coarse, not fine, not short, not long, not glowing, not adhesive, without shadow, without darkness, without air, space, stickiness. It is intangible, odorless, tasteless, without eye, without ear, without voice, without wind, without energy, without breath, without mouth, without personal or family name. Unaging, undying, without fear, immortal, stainless, not uncovered, not covered, without measure, without inside, without outside. Now listen very carefully. It consumes nothing so ever. No one so ever consumes it. Now let us spend a little while meditating on these two quotations. I'll read the first one again, and after a few minutes, I'll read the second one again. The Atma is the unseen seer, unheard hearer, etc., unthought thinker, ununderstood understander. Other than the Atma, there is no seer. Other than he, there is no hearer, no thinker, no understander. That is the Atma, the inner controller, immortal. Now, try and, in this process of meditation, just be sensitive, as sensitive as one possibly can, to the inner meaning of the words. Don't let the mind talk about that inner meaning. The words which have been spoken are quite sufficient. Let the words yield up their secret to the quiet, silent mind. Now let us look at this other quotation. I think I ought to tell you beforehand that the first question which Gargi asked was this: that which is above the heavens, below the earth, in between, etc., on what is all that woven, warp, and woof? And in this context, regard heavens, earth, etc., primarily in terms of one's mode of awareness in the moment. When one is concerned with worldly things, that is what the word earth represents. When one is concerned with deep things of the mind, that is heaven, your state of consciousness. You see? And Yajnavalkya answers, all that is woven across akasha. Now you'll find akasha translated as space, as sky, and sometimes as the void. But I think if you use the English translation I suggest, mind space, you will understand akasha more deeply and truly. Mind space is the real meaning of this void which Hinduism and Buddhism talk of. Because mind space has no dimensions. It is immeasurable. Therefore, it has none of the limitations which we experience and are conscious of in relation to the word space as we use it in the ordinary, everyday physical sense. It's a container in the physical sense, a box, a vast box, in which are limited finite objects. Thoughts, ideas are all limited finite things. They are mortal. They are the contained, the content of consciousness, the content of mind. But neither they nor the container, if you like to use that word, mind space, has any measurable dimensions. This is the extraordinary part of it. But as you know, the mind has fundamental influence over our daily life. Because our daily life is the result of desire, thought, etc. Now, so Yajnavalkya answered, all this is woven across akasha. The void which is mind space. And then Gargi asks, across what then, pray, is akasha woven, warp and woof? So you see, mind is not the ultimate real. There is something which is even profounder than that. And Yajnavalkya answers, that, O Gargi, Brahmins call the imperishable. And then he uses all the negatives. Not coarse, not fine, not short, not long, etc. I won't repeat the whole lot. You can just say not to everything that we know through our sense experience in the world. None of these qualities apply to it. But remember that all these qualities of the sense functions emerge out of this imperishable. That's the mystery. That is why this great problem of the philosophy, in the philosophy of religion, did God create the world out of nothing? Very definitely yes, and equally definitely no. See? So, not this, not that, and so on. But this is the important part. Unaging, undying, without fear. Very interesting that fear is singled out. Immortal, stainless, utterly pure. Not uncovered, not covered. So the whole idea of container and contained is transcended. Without measure, without inside, without outside. And therefore, inconceivable by our brain-mind activity. You can't picture it. But you can realize it through experience if one can enter into that state of communion. That is how it was possible to say these things. It consumes nothing so ever. This is terribly important. No one so ever consumes it. That is the imperishable. Now, let's spend a few minutes with that. If the awareness of the imperishable grows in intensity till it becomes a real glowing, white-hot awareness, you will notice that the denudation process is intensified. The tendency sometimes is to get into a sleepy state. You could enter into a kind of a spiritual coma. And that's no use. Awareness becomes intensified. And in that intensification, it becomes calmer and calmer, and it becomes more and more absorptive. Absorptive of what? See, we as we are sitting here cannot shut out external stimuli, particularly traffic sounds, other sounds, and so forth. The tendency of the person who is trying to meditate and the tendency of the one who has not received the right sort of instruction is to fight against the external stimulus. That is quite a mistake. You fight against nothing whatsoever. You absorb everything. Because isn't that the characteristic of the totality? The totality contains everything. It doesn't throw anything out anywhere. It can't. This absorptiveness comes. And you will find that in that state of absorptiveness, a totally new relationship between your whole being and that other stimulus rises up. This is the state of unity. This is a state of communion. Now, another point in connection with those two very wonderful lines. It consumes nothing so ever. Transcendence does not consume anything. It destroys, it annihilates nothing. Perhaps you may look at it this way if it is helpful. I'll present the positive aspect first. The invisible light, the infinite, the absolute, produces the incomprehensible dark. And it is out of that incomprehensible dark that the entire process of manifestation, of change, of development, of growth, of fulfillment comes into being. Hasn't mankind through the ages talked of growth and fulfillment, not only of himself but of everything, as a coming to light? But the light itself is invisible, which is also the actual physical scientific fact about light. It's invisible. It's only because it is reflected from an object that we see that object, or we say we see light. If concrete, finite, limited, mortal thing were not present, light would everlastingly be invisible. Now, when you enter into the deep states of meditation, you can actually experience this if you do really enter into them, if you can really enter into them. It consumes nothing so ever. Apply that to oneself in the first instance. It's sufficient to apply to oneself really to appreciate and understand it. It applies to the whole universe, but you are meditating, so apply it to yourself. When you are in the state of complete psychophysical harmony, there is no destructive metabolic process going on. It is only transformative. If you can enter into this state where the imperishable is completely realized through your being, then as long as that physical organism, that psychophysical organism is there in that state, that psychophysical organism itself does not age. The metabolism of the living body doesn't bring you any closer to the death of that body. That is one thing, one phenomenon. But it's only a phenomenon. The trouble is that when one speaks of these things, the unwary person says, "Ah, I can now live 100 years more if I practice meditation as because Firoz said so and so." Never mind what Firoz said. You meditate. You enter into communion. Besides, such a thing never happens because the particular psychophysical organism which enters into that state is never left alone by the world around. The world around impinges upon it, wakes it up, but you say not so much wakes it up as takes it out of that condition. You see, paradise is temporal. The bliss, the ananda of Brahman, the Absolute, is other than the happiness of paradise. Because paradise is a produced state, not the eternal state. That eternal never needs to consume anything. That invisible light, by virtue of its presence, so influences the incomprehensible dark that everything happens in it in terms of transformation. There is no annihilation. You will find that it defeats the intellect. The intellect will go quite far producing ideas out of what I've just tried to put before you. Use them, look at the ideas, understand them, and drop them. Let them pass. Thoughts, inspirations, exalted states, they all belong to the mortal. The immortal is the ungraspable. Now, in connection with that, you know that marvelous statement that the Atma is not this, not this, not this, neti neti, the famous formula. And Yajnavalkya also says it is unseizable, and the reason he gives is for it cannot be seized, which doesn't require a brilliant brain to state. It is indestructible because it cannot be destroyed. It is not injured. It does not tremble. You see, what wonderful terms he uses. So completely meaningful in the context of the deeps of religion, in the context of transcendence, but so rather absurd sounding in the context of logical intellectual discourse. I, being a university professor, want to hear some marvelous logical presentation of some profound ideas. All in beautiful succession, you see. Nonsense. All that is the sport of the Lord. He just laughs at it. Neti, neti. So now, this kind of thing defeats the intellect. And be happy that the intellect is defeated. Because if the intellect is defeated, but your vital energy is active in communion, is actively communing, then the communion will be unhindered by the monkeying about of the brilliant intellect. You see, this is why it's almost impossible to discuss these things in the ordinary way with the learned. And you know what they say about learning and the learned. In the Amrita Bindu Upanishad, the Holy One tells his disciple, having studied the books, the scriptures well, the learned man should persevere studiously in the acquisition of jnana, or self-knowledge, and vijnana, or self-realization. Self, of course, is the translation given here for atma, atma-realization, according to such knowledge. Then he should discard the whole of the books as a person in quest of grain gives up the straw. Books are just straw. Sometimes the straw burns a little bit better than the books. I want to go on to something else today. And this is in connection with the Isha Upanishad. It is the shortest of the Upanishads, just 18 verses. And I'm going to read, first of all, Mascaro's translation. Mascaro takes happy liberties, inspirational liberties, in translation. Behold the universe in the glory of God, and all that lives and moves on earth. Leaving the transient, find joy in the eternal. Set not your heart on another's possession. In this context, this does not merely mean be free of covetousness. That, of course, is taken for granted. That was all kindergarten work, to be completely free of all covetousness and so forth. Set not your heart on another's possession. In this case, one of its basic meanings is, do not envy another holy one's, a holy one's realization. One may say, one may use in language the term, he possesses God. Mystics use phrases of that type. Well, don't envy that. Set not your heart on another's possession. That's one meaning, the envy aspect of it. Because you can have envy in the spiritual realm too. The other meaning is this. And this is the important thing. Each one's realization of God, of the ultimate real, of nirvana, or what you like to call it, is unique to him. It's no good setting your heart on the other's realization, the realization through the other. It is different there from what it will be in you and what it can be in you. So it's useless to set your heart on another's possession. Very practical too, isn't it? Working thus, a man may wish for a life of 100 years. Only actions done in God bind not the soul of man. All other actions bind. There are demon-haunted worlds, regions of utter darkness. Whoever in life denies the spirit falls into that darkness of death. The demons are our own creation, our own desires and passions and whims and fancies and graspings and all the rest of it. Those are the demon-haunted worlds which we create ourselves. No one else creates them. The spirit without moving is swifter than the mind. The senses cannot reach him. He is ever beyond them. Standing still, he overtakes those who run. To the ocean of his being, the spirit of life leads the streams of action. He moves, and he moves not. He is far, and he is near. He is within all, and he is outside all. He who sees all beings in his own self, and his own self in all beings, loses all fear. When a sage sees this great unity and his self has become all things, all beings, what delusion and what sorrow can ever be near him? The spirit filled all with his radiance. He is incorporeal and invulnerable, pure and untouched by evil. He is the supreme seer and thinker, immanent and transcendent. He placed all things in the path of eternity. This is a translation by a genius. Now, this is what I want to deal with. Into deep darkness fall those who follow action. Into deeper darkness fall those who follow knowledge. One is the outcome of knowledge, and another is the outcome of action. Outcome meaning the result of. Thus have we heard from the ancient sages who explained this truth to us. He who knows both knowledge and action, with action overcomes death, and with knowledge reaches immortality. Into deep darkness fall those who follow the immanent. Into deeper darkness fall those who follow the transcendent. One is the outcome of the transcendent, and another is the outcome of the immanent. Thus have we heard from the ancient sages who explained this truth to us. He who knows both the transcendent and the immanent, with the immanent overcomes death, and with the transcendent reaches immortality. Now, I'm going to use the conventional literal translation, because Mascaro has taken the poet's liberty in using the word action and in using the words immanent and transcendent. Into blinding darkness enter those who worship ignorance, not action. The word used is avidya. And those who delight in knowledge, that is vidya, enter into still greater darkness, as it were. Then the next verse is like the other translation. Distinct indeed, they say, is the result of knowledge, and distinct, they say, is the result of ignorance. Thus have we heard from those wise who have explained to us these. Knowledge and ignorance. He who knows the two together crosses death through ignorance and attains life eternal through knowledge. Now this is still quite puzzling, isn't it? Let's look at the next set. Into blinding darkness enter those who worship the unmanifest. That is the exact, the correct translation. Asambhutim is the Sanskrit word used there. Asambhutim. And into still greater darkness, as it were, those who delight in the manifest. And there, the manifest is sambhutim. Asambhutim is the unmanifest. Then the other verse is, as in the previous case, distinct indeed, they say, is what results from the manifest and from the unmanifest, and so on. He who understands the manifest and the unmanifest both together crosses death through the unmanifest and attains life eternal through the manifest. Now look, in this last verse, neither Radhakrishnan nor Mascaro have refrained from taking liberties. In this last verse, Radhakrishnan says, he who understands the manifest and the unmanifest. Actually, the words used are sambhutim, which does mean the manifest, and the other word used is not unmanifest, but vinasham, destruction. Now, if you use the original Sanskrit words as they stand, it becomes possible to understand this. Tie this up with something which occurs in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad when Yajnavalkya says that it is only whilst we are here that we may understand it. That is the ultimate real. Understand it in the sense, ultimately, of realizing it. Only whilst we are here. Now, whilst we are here, everything undergoes death. Things, situations, events, people, thoughts, feelings, ideas, plans, efforts, everything uprises, proceeds, dies. It is a cycle of mortality. Now, the individual caught in this cycle of mortality, insensitive to the profounder real, to the transcendent, we may well use the word transcendent there, insensitive to the transcendent, remains in this state. Yajnavalkya says in the Brihadaranyaka, he who knows it not goes to sorrow only. He who knows it will also die physically, of course. But he will have realized, or that is to say, through him, the realization, the making real of transcendence, the shining of transcendence through him will take place. You see? Now, in the Isha Upanishad, the word sambhutim, the manifest, that is you here, I here, as we are, alive and functioning, we are manifest. And we experience death, the death of everything all along the line. If we really understand this and let go of all clinging to that which is everlastingly being born and dying and being born and dying and so forth, then here, whilst we are manifest, immortality is realized. There is no other immortality for the individual man, the person here. There is no other immortality whatsoever. Only the totality, the absolute, the ultimate, is the real. And I prefer to use this phrase, one total reality. I've constantly used it for years and years, simply because by using this phrase, one can save oneself from thinking of the absolute, the transcendent, as that thing over there. The moment the mind plays that trick, it's that thing over there, you have destroyed the reality, even the deep intellectual meaning of the word absolute. You've made it a relative something. See? So now, whilst one is here, the self-conscious person, fully understanding the deathful nature of the becoming process, no longer clings to it, his awareness undergoes an extraordinary transformation, and he sees the birth-death process from moment to moment, but somehow he is completely filled, completely lighted up with the awareness of total reality, whose manifestation is this, are these multitudinous, ever-changing garbs. You see? Now, if one mistakenly chases the manifest, you will be chasing death and misery. If out of ignorance you chase the unmanifest, the transcendent, you will land yourself into an almost profounder darkness. Because the intellect will have told you that this is the void, the great void. The intellect will also have told you this is the ultimate plenum, the plenitude, the fullness. But these are words. Can the mind picture the fullness? Can the mind picture the void? As I have said so often before, take your teacup and measure the volume of the Atlantic. Can't do it. You see? It's like that. So, into blind darkness enter those who, let's take the exact words as they stand. Into blinding darkness enter those who worship, upasate is the word used, who worship avidya. That is, all this here. You may remember more than once we have considered the meaning of this word vidya. Vidya means not knowledge in our ordinary sense of the word, the acquisition of an idea or a fact or knowing in the ordinary sense. Vidya in the religious context, especially in the context of the Upanishads, means that which you are said to know because you have become what you know in consciousness. That is what vidya is. And avidya is that which you know superficially. You know as an object of knowledge. All that is avidya. The knowing of the Upanishads and the Vedas is also ignorance. Knowing in the ordinary sense of the word. You know the words of the Vedas and the Upanishads. You know all the thoughts and the discussions and interpretations and all the rest of it. That is all ignorance. That is why they say, when you have dealt with all that to start with, then get rid of your books. Like the person who, in search of grain, gets rid of the straw. See? So, into blinding darkness enter those who worship avidya, the acquisition of knowledge. and those who delight in knowledge, vidya, enter into still greater darkness, as it were, because you attempt to conceive of the void and the plenitude, of the inconceivable, the immeasurable, in terms of conceptions and measure. And the same with the unmanifest, asambhutim and sambhutim. And then in the next verse, the verse after next, he has sambhutim, the manifest. He does not have asambhutim, but he has vinasham. Now, so many people have been, I would say, with all due apologies to the great one, Shankara has misled people for centuries with his suggestions as to how to interpret them. I think that is his suggestions are not good. This is how I feel about it. You can take it or leave it as you please. The words of the Buddha, do what you think fit. Now, is there any perplexity with respect to this? Or does one see? Why the one is called entering into blind darkness or blinding darkness, andham. And the other, which is supposed to be the transcendent and all the rest of it, is even more so.